by the shores of old Lake Michigan, where the hawk wind blows so cold. An old Cub fan lay dying in his midnight hour, the toll. Round his bed, his friends had all gathered. They knew his time was short. And on his head, they put this bright blue cap from his all-time favorite sport. He told him, it's late, it's getting dark in here, and I know it's time to go. But before I leave the lineup, boys, there's just one thing that I'd like to know. Do they still play the blues in Chicago when baseball season rolls around? When the snow melts away, do the Cubbies still play?
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Jeff Bosser, joined by Dan Simeone. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. Our technical director is Henry Frayne. You've just heard Steve Goodman perform a dying Cub fan last request, and we'll use that to segue into today's guest and discuss his latest book. Dan and I will be talking with author Glenn Stout. Since 1986, Mr. Stout has been a freelance writer, penning, ghostwriting, or editing more than 70 books. His work includes The Dodgers, 120 Years of Dodgers Baseball, Yankees Century, Red Sox Century, as well as books on Jackie Robinson and Joe DiMaggio. He's also written outside the sports world. His book, 9 Months at Ground Zero, is an oral history of the cleanup of that site following the September 11th attacks. Mr. Stout also serves as editor of the Best American Sports Writer series, writes a monthly column for Boston Baseball, and has made numerous TV and radio appearances, including those on ESPN, HBO, and NPR. Today we'll discuss his book, The Cubs, the complete story of Chicago Cubs baseball. This definitive narrative history traces the team to its origins in the 1860s, tracking it until nearly the present day. Good afternoon, Mr. Stout.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Just fine. Could you talk a little bit about this undertaking? You've, as I mentioned, you've written several other books on team's history. I was wondering why it took so long for someone to write a complete history of the Cubs.
Well, I know why it took me so long to write the history of the Cubs. We, you know, myself and my colleague Richard Johnson, who I do these books with, we first did a book on the Red Sox, which came out in 2000, just as they turned 100 years old. And then we, after we did that one, we decided, well, there are some natural follow-ups to do. The Yankees were certainly one. And then you start casting about for the other teams that we consider among the most essential in the game. And that was the Dodgers and then the Cubs. You know, I've always argued that the Red Sox might be the most interesting team. The Yankees are certainly the most successful. The Dodgers, in a way, are the most essential. But the Cubs, in their own way, are the most aggravating. And in that regard, they are a gift to any historian because the stories are endless and just great fun to dive in.
Yeah, and I, Mr. Stout, this is Dan Simeone, and I've been a Cub fan all my life. And what I want to know is, how were you able to maintain a positive attitude in writing this history of failure?
Well, what you try to do, and it's funny because people always ask me, like after the Red Sox book, they'd say, oh, are you a Red Sox fan or are you a Yankee fan after the Yankee book? I'm a baseball fan. But the experience of writing any of these books, but particularly this one, is that by the end of the process, you really start identifying with the fans of the teams. You know, the things that you find in their history, particularly those frustrating moments or the duh moments where you just want to hit your head and think, how could they be so stupid? You know, you start feeling like a fan at that point. The only way to remain optimistic is, you know, I think back basically to the Red Sox book. When we wrote that, it looked like the Red Sox would never win a world championship. And lo and behold, just a few years later, they did. So if we have the same kind of luck with this book, I think Cub fans will be pretty happy.
And there's a huge history there. One thing I wanted to ask you is the history tracing back to, what, 1867, I believe. Was it hard to find chronicle information about that time?
Well, particularly the early years, it's sometimes very difficult to find because, you know, a lot of other books have chronicled portions of Cubs history, particularly more recent history. I mean, there are a number of books just about 1969 alone. But when you try to do a comprehensive history and you have to go all the way back to the very beginning, you often find, and I try not to write from other books, you know, hardly at all. I try to do primary research, which in this instance is many cases with old newspapers. So you go back to the old newspapers and you try to ferret out information from those. And that's a very time-consuming and labor-intensive process. I ended up spending every waking moment for a week during the hours the Chicago Public Library was open once when I went to Chicago just doing research, and primarily research before 1900, because that's the only way to get at this material. And the Cubs are a particular challenge because you can argue that they are the oldest franchise in baseball history. They have not moved. They went under for a few years after the fire. But the Cubs have basically been the same franchise since the very beginning. So their history is longer than everyone else's. And, you know, when you're going back to the 1860s, 1870s, sometimes that information is very hard to ferret out.
We're talking with Glenn Stout about his book, The Cubs, The Complete Story of Chicago Cubs Baseball. We welcome your calls at 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana or outside the region, 800-222-9455. We've already got a caller on line one in Urbana. Go ahead.
I am a Cub fan, not by choice, but by heredity. My family lived in the western suburbs of Chicago. My mother, my grandmother, my aunts, my uncles, they're all Cub fans. So on opening day, my mother let us cut school to go to the game. I'm so old that I remember that Ladies' Day, you got in for a quarter. They called it a tax ticket. But what I'm wondering is, why are they so bad? Do they? It seems to me, and I haven't been an avid fan for a long time, that they trade away any good pitcher, any good hitter that they get. And I'll hang up and listen. It wouldn't make any difference whether they won or lost. I was at the 1945 game against St. Louis when they won the pennant. So I'm just incurably a Cub fan, but I'll hang up and listen.
Well, one of the things that we bring up in the book, you know, that's what we try to do. We try to explain why they've won when they won and why they've lost when they lost. And I think one of the reasons why the Cubs have found it so difficult to win is that for long stretches of their history, and particularly long stretches of their recent history since they last won, which is nearly 100 years now, almost without fail, whoever has owned the team, the Cubs have been a secondary part of their business. That was certainly the case with William Wrigley. It was obvious the case with his son, Philip Wrigley. And it's also been the case with the Tribune Corporation. The Cubs have been a nice bauble for somebody to have as an adjunct to their other business. You know, William Wrigley used the Cubs to help promote his chewing gum. You know, Phil Wrigley, when he took over after his father died, his main focus was the Wrigley Company. He kept the Cubs because his father told him never to get rid of them. So he kept them to adhere to this promise that he made to his father. But if you look at it closely, you know, he didn't really care. It really didn't matter to him whether the Cubs won or not. His father would have liked the Cubs to win and actually was quite interested in them. But P.K. Wrigley, it didn't matter if the Cubs won, and he certainly had the resources to turn them into a winner. I mean, this was an extraordinarily wealthy man. This was someone that when, you know, baseball integrated under Jackie Robinson, had he been bold, had he followed in the Dodgers' wake and perhaps integrated the Cubs 5 or 6 years earlier than he did, the Cubs could have, you know, taken advantage of all the talent coming out of the Negro Leagues. Yet he didn't do that. When other teams were backing off from their farm systems in the late 50s and early 60s, he could have built a strong farm system. He didn't do that. It just didn't matter to him. And similarly, when the Tribune Corporation took over, you know, having the Cubs was a nice way to give the corporation, to increase the profile of the corporation. If the Cubs win, great, but it has never been really necessary. And what I argue in the book is that, you know, perhaps that won't take place, the Cubs won't win, until you've got somebody in charge who really feels what the fans do, who has the Cubs as a priority. Now, I think what's interesting in the past, you know, year and a half or so since the Cubs, since it was announced that the Tribune Company was putting the Cubs up for sale, is that everybody likes to win on the way out the door. So all of a sudden, money seems to be no object. After, for years and years, money has been the object. You know, the Cubs didn't go after free agents for years and years simply because of money. So that's what I would offer, is that the Cubs have simply not been a priority for the people who have been running the team.
This is Dan again. I was reading the paper this morning, in fact, quote from Ramos Ramirez, and like so many Cubs in recent times, is responding to this century of frustration. And he said, well, you know, the real reason the Cubs haven't won the World Series in such a long time is really pretty simple. They just weren't the best team.
Well, that's part of it, too, you know, and, you know, because I don't think they have been the best team. I mean, I look at 1969 quite closely, and I think a lot of Cubs fans think that, you know, that the Cubs were somehow wronged in 69, that they were the best team that year and they should have won. And I disagree. The Cubs basically, you know, had one really good hot stretch and then played barely 500 baseball for half the year. And that's not the mark of a great team. But you certainly have to have the players, and one way to have the players is for ownership to be committed to getting them and to be committed to spending money after them. I mean, you had instances in the late 1950s and early 1960s where the Cubs basically didn't spend any bonus money signing young players. They just decided not to participate. And, you know, if they were trying to lose, that's what you would have done. You know, so there certainly is some room, you know, to criticize what's taken place under some of the ownership groups.
Going back to the start of the 20th century, one thing I want to quote before we move into a little more modern times is the origins of the team name. They weren't originally the Cubs. They were the White Stockings, then the Colts, the Orphans, the Remnants. And what brought about the team logo was a quote from a reporter with the Chicago Daily News.
Right, yeah, he just, you know, referred to them in print because they were a youthful team, as the Cubs. And I think it was, you know, some typesetter, you know, instead of using the lowercase c, used the uppercase C. And, you know, it was just one of those things where that was the name that took. I mean, because, you know, you had other years they were called the Remnants and things like that. I mean, a lot of these names were unofficial because in the early years of baseball, particularly in cities that had two teams in each league, which was the case in Chicago, you know, you referred to the team, the Chicago, the Nationals, for the National League team, and the Americans as the American League team. But, you know, fans out in the bars and in the taverns and in the stands would come up with their own nicknames for the team. And the Cubs is the one that actually stuck and then got adopted as the official name of the team.
Yeah, you've talked a little bit about racism and the effect that that had on the Cubs grabbing players from the Negro Leagues. And I know, you know, a lot of the attention sometimes is focused on goats and black cats and mm-hmm. Bartman. But certainly I would think when you look at the real reasons for the history of difficulty, a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, at a time when they had an opportunity to go and get some of the best black baseball players in the country, they didn't do it.
Right. And I think it's particularly aggravating in terms of the Cubs and in terms of Phil Wrigley because, you know, Wrigley as an employer for the Wrigley Corporation, he was actually, you know, quite progressive in many ways. And the Wrigley Corporation, the gum company, actually employed quite a high number of African Americans. Yet when he'd be pressured by people from the community, religious leaders, about integrating the Cubs, it clearly was not a priority for him. And then some of the people that I think he turned over the reins of the organization to, it was also clearly not their priority. There was one instance in the early 1950s where the Cubs actually made the public announcement that they weren't going to bring up any players from their minor league team in California without the permission of the president of that team and the sports writers out there. Which made no sense at all. You're going to let other people decide who you bring up to the major league team. Well, one of the reasons they did that was because Gene Baker, who was then a shortstop, African-American player, was playing for that team. And by making that decision, the Cubs absolved themselves of the responsibility of having to make a decision whether or not to bring up Gene Baker. Gene Baker was a really good player, particularly in AAA, and of course the team wasn't going to give him up, you know, and lose games on their own and just tell the Cubs go ahead and take him. If they had the choice, they were going to keep Gene Baker, and that's exactly what they did. And for a couple of years, Baker probably could have played for the Cubs earlier than he did, but he was left to languish in the minor leagues. And that's a particularly sad chapter. Sadly, it's also not a unique one. You can go through any number of major league teams, and, you know, it certainly was the case with the Red Sox and also to a degree with the Yankees, and they followed the same pattern. What's aggravating about the Cubs is the Cubs, you know, we're not doing well, and to not take advantage of something like that is just particularly sad because had they been bold with Wrigley's money and by going to the Negro Leagues as one of the first teams, they certainly could have set themselves up as a dynasty going into the 1950s and 1960s, and they squandered that opportunity.
The caller we had mentioned, I believe, watching a 1945 game, and that made me think about a quote I have marked here in your book and talked about how much success they had in the first part of the 20th century. I mean, and I'm going to quote from the quote here. You said, for the ninth time in 36 seasons, the Cubs, although they had one world title to their credit, would play in the World Series. This was in 45. Only the New York Giants and Yankees with 10 and 14 pennants respectively had more appearances in the World Series. The Chicago Cubs, without question, were one of the most successful franchises in the game. Imagine that. And I'd like to, you know, maybe just remind people that this was a dominant franchise going through the early 40s.
And it was the power of the market. I mean, it was no accident that the other, you know, successful teams were from, you know, the Yankees and the Giants were from big markets. And the Cubs were a big market team, and particularly after the demise of the White Sox, after the Black Sox scandal, you know, the Cubs basically had Chicago to themselves in between the wars. Never quite took advantage of it to the degree they should have, but, you know, they drew enough fans, they were making enough money to be competitive, and they were regularly being successful. You know, and if you go back even farther to their, you know, pennant winners in 07 and 08, you know, that was when they were really at the top of the baseball world. So they did have this enormous long tradition of winning. And to a degree, I often wonder if maybe, you know, maybe they just thought that that's the way it was going to be all the time. And they didn't have to do too much to continue winning. And, well, then 1945 became 1950, became 55, became 60, and they're still waiting to win because, well, they'd always won every few years anyway. Maybe not a World Series, but they'd been in the World Series, and as if that was somehow destiny. But, you know, as Cub fans learned painfully, I think, that wasn't the case, that you don't just win by showing up on the field. You actually have to, you know, actively move towards that goal.
One thing I was really disappointed to hear about was the 1935 team and the anti-Semitism that took place towards the Tiger star player, Hank Greenberg.
Yeah, that's something that I really hadn't read anywhere. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I like to go back to the, you know, original source material, the newspapers written at the time, and I'm reading about that World Series, and there was this overt, blatant anti-Semitic activity directed at Hank Greenberg. He was beamed. He was spiked. You know, they yelled epithets at him quite openly, to the point that the commissioner of baseball at the time, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, actually had to step in and, you know, get word to the Cubs that they really needed to tone it down a little bit because it was actually being written about in the mainstream papers, which generally would overlook things like that unless it was really pronounced. But, and I'm a little harsh on that team because I actually say, you know, they lost and they deserve to, because it was completely over-the-top behavior. And, of course, Greenberg then comes back a few years later when he gets to play the Cubs again, and he gets his revenge because he ends up having a great series and almost beats the Cubs by himself.
I'd like your observations about the tensions between baseball as a sport and baseball as a business. I guess it was in the 20s that William Wrigley said, baseball is too much of a sport to be a business and too much of a business to be a sport.
Yeah, and he really hit the nail on the head there. And in a sense, I think you can argue that the Cubs have been stuck between those two poles for much of the last, 100 years, because getting back to what I was saying before, how they've always been an adjunct to a larger business, that puts this larger business in the position of how do we treat the Cubs? If we just treat them like a business, well, then the only thing that matters is if they're profitable. And for much of the Cubs' history, the Cubs have been profitable. There's no question about that. But that doesn't satisfy the baseball end of things. Fans, I think, could care less about profit. The only, they measure profit in wins and losses and in championships. So that's why I've argued that I think what's one of the things that's hurt the Cubs over the years is that there hasn't been that one guy running everything who doesn't care anymore about how much money he makes, that just wants to win. I mean, you've had these owners go into with the Florida Marlins and win with them because they haven't cared about how much money they've made. They just care about winning. And, granted, they've won, destroyed the team, sold, and then gotten out, but at least they did that. And I think Cub fans over the last 100 years would have, that would have been a trade they would have agreed to have a couple of teams win, even if the team ends up getting torn down afterwards. At least you've got that victory there. I think it's fortunate. The Cubs are actually fortunate now that since the team is in the process of being sold, the business end doesn't really matter as much anymore. I mean, I think the Tribune Company is worried about their legacy at this point with the team, and I think they'd love to win on the way out the door, and nothing would enhance the value of the franchise more than actually selling it when the team's in first place or has just won a World Series. That's precisely what took place in Boston several years ago when the previous ownership group, on their way out the door, decided to spend ungodly amounts of money and sign players like Manny Ramirez or trade for Manny Ramirez and big contracts because they desperately wanted to win before they turned over the reins. They didn't, but they left a relatively good foundation for the ownership group that followed.
We're talking with Glenn Stout about his book, The Cubs, The Complete Story of Chicago Cubs Baseball. We welcome your calls at 333-9455 in the Champaign-Urbana area, outside of the region, 800-222-9455. I wonder if you can draw parallels between having Ernie Banks and him being in his prime and really the top draw at the park and probably what allowed Mr. Wrigley to not have to spend much on players at that time because Ernie was playing. And then, you look ahead so many years to Sammy Sosa. I mean, there was a stretch in the 90s where Sammy hit one out and that's what you went for.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sad that they, particularly in the case of Banks, that, Banks was such a good player, and particularly for the first 5 or 6 years, his first 5 or 6 years with the team in the 1950s. He was such a good player. They really didn't need to do too much to put around him to have had a really good team, yet they never made the move, again, I think because they never felt the financial need to. Sosa was a similar example. He was a singularly spectacular player, albeit perhaps with a little help. We're still not completely sure about that, but he was the draw, and I think they saw, that's enough. We've got the star that's going to bring people into Wrigley Field, and that's enough. We don't need to do anything else. And you did have this player who, like Banks, Sosa was effervescent. Particularly in his earlier years in Chicago, people were really drawn to him. He didn't have the reputation that he had, finally when he left as someone who was all about himself. And again, it's just unfortunate that you squandered having this great player that you really didn't need to do too much. You didn't have to put that many other great players around him to have a really good team, and they just never did. In a way, they used each of those players as an excuse to do less. And that's really unfortunate.
It's interesting, the number of interesting individual stories in the book. But one of the ones that I recall best was the 1929 World Series when the Cubs were playing the Athletics. And I don't know if you remember this particular incident, but I guess Connie Mack was the manager of the Athletics, and the Cubs had some pretty heavy hitters at the time, Hack Wilson and Rogers Hornsby, Kiki Kyler and others, and the expectation was it was going to be a match of the Cubs' big hitters against the fireballers of the Athletics, particularly Lefty Grove, I guess. And Connie Mack sort of pulled a fast one.
He sure did. He had a player on his team who was named Howard Emke. And Howard Emke was at the end of not a bad career. He was actually a pretty good player. He'd won 20 games, I think, once in his career, but was never known as a hard thrower, and certainly wasn't a hard thrower towards the end of his career. And Connie Mack told him sometime before the World Series that he was going to be pitching against the Cubs, and actually sent him out, and Emke scouted the Cubs himself, you know, spent time watching them from the stands, deciding on how he was going to pitch against them. And then, of course, Emke comes out and just carves up that lineup, and no one could believe, one, that he was pitching, and two, that he pitched so well against them. But, you know, the audacity of a manager to do something like that. This would be like Lou Piniella right now sending, Rich Hill out to follow the Boston Red Sox for a couple of months and tell him, you know, if we get to the World Series, you know, I'm going to bring you up and you're going to start game one. I mean, it's just unthinkable. But I guess that's the reason Connie Mack's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, and it was interesting because I guess Emke was clearly more of a pitcher than a
right.
overpowering fastball pitcher, but then Mack comes back the next game after they're used to watching Emke throw these softballs up there and strike them out. Then he comes back with Earnshaw and Grove, who were the fireballers on the team, and sort of kept the Cubs off balance the rest of the series.
Right. I mean, he completely outthought the Cubs and beat them. You know, they were almost beat before the World Series started. He had this plan. He put it into place. And once Emke did what he did, that was it, you know. And that's, you know, the pure genius. But also, I just think, like, just what an audacious move for a manager to make. And then for Emke, too, who I think struck out something like 11 or 12 that game, you know, to actually be able to put it into practice, you know, is quite extraordinary. But, you know, that was a time period, too, where the Cubs were, as has been the case many times, they were heavily dependent on hitting. That's one of the reasons I was so glad to see here a couple weeks ago that, you know, after the Milwaukee went out and got CC Sabathia, the Cubs reacted by getting a pitcher and didn't react by getting a hitter, because I think in many years in the past, the Cubs might have made a move, a midseason move to do something. They probably would have picked up a hitter. And it was nice to see them, you know, go match one for one by following up Sabathia with Harden.
Since we've gone back quite a ways, let's go back to the last championship and Fred Merkel. It took a base running gaffe by a supposed base running gaffe by a New York Giants shortstop to, I guess you could call maybe a Steve Bartman move by a player in order for the Cubs to reach the World Series 100 years ago.
Right. I mean, it's a famous incident in which, you know, at the end of the game, Fred Merkel, you know, failed to touch second base. You know, another runner scored, and instead of going to touch second base, he didn't. So they were able to call for the ball, put him out at second base, which the end result was, this is a game against the Giants, the game had to be replayed. And, you know, it's that kind of quirky event that the Cubs of that era were able to take advantage of.
Another thing that I found in the book that I didn't know before was the fact that Cubs almost had lights at Wrigley Field before the war.
Right. They were ready to install the lights. In fact, apparently all the wires and the stanchions were already at the ballpark stored underneath the stands. And then Pearl Harbor happened. And naturally there was a call for resources. And Phil Wrigley, you know, did his part, as I think a lot of people in Major League Baseball did, and he donated the medal to the war effort. Had that not been the case, you wouldn't have had the battles, you know, 20 years ago over whether or not there should be lights in Wrigley Field. They already would have been there. And, in fact, that was the time period where an awful lot of ballparks got their lights, either just before or more often just after World War II.
As someone who has sort of studied not just the Cubs over the history of baseball, but a number of other teams. I have to ask you, why have pitchers gotten so soft?
Well, as an old pitcher myself, I do ask that question. You know, I think part of the reason is the monetary investment that they put in a number one, number two draft pick is so huge now. You know, you have to pay someone $1 million, $2 million just to sign a professional contract. And then once you reach the big leagues, if you're successful, then you're being paid $10, $12, $15 million a year. I think that's accelerated a movement that was already in place to kind of baby pitchers a little bit. But I think it's really accelerated it. They are so afraid of losing that investment that at a certain point it's not a ball player. It's a stack of stocks and bonds. And if you do something that you know, causes this guy to tweak his elbow, and the easiest charge to make is that you overused someone. So I think guys are babied a lot. The other thing, too, that I think is taking place now that has contributed to it, and this is maybe a little more obscure, is that in the era of free agency, besides money, something else has taken place, and that is that for the first time in baseball history, really, players were able to work out all year long. And, A, I'm not sure if that was particularly good for pitchers, that might have led to being a little too muscle-bound. It was certainly good for hitters, though, and I think it became more difficult for pitchers to pitch, so that instead of just facing, you know, a couple of guys on each team who could really drive the ball, all of a sudden you're facing a lot of guys who can really drive the ball, so you really didn't have an opportunity to coast during a game. You had to throw hard and, you know, on every pitch. Every pitch was stressful, and I think that's added to it as well. And then you throw in performance-enhancing drugs on top of that, and then that's a whole other issue. But, you know, the days of one of my favorite players writing about the Cubs was a pitcher for the Cubs in the late 20s and early 1930s named Charlie Root. And Charlie Root had one year where I think he won 27 ball games, but he was also called to pitch in relief like 25 times.
Wow.
Anytime they needed him, you know, he was called on. Joe McCarthy was the manager then. Joe McCarthy called on him and pitched him. And Charlie Root was not a big guy. He only weighed about 180 pounds. Over the course of that year, he lost 20 pounds during the season. And he had been spectacular that year until about the middle of August. And then he really ran out of steam. And although he was a valuable pitcher for a number of years afterwards, he never again approached the performance that he had that one season.
I wonder if we could move ahead to the early 60s and talk about Mr. Wrigley maybe thinking he was being innovative. There was this College of Coaches that took place during that stretch, and it ended up being just competition between the coaches trying to better the play of the team when it was their turn.
Right. Wrigley prided himself on being, you know, something of an innovator and thinking outside the box. And in a funny way, he was. I mean, at various times, he employed like a psychologist to study his team and, you know, tried to make use of, you know, new statistics. But one of his ideas, one of the more harebrained ideas, was the whole concept of having a rotating coaching staff. He didn't see the need to have a single manager, but he thought, well, if we have, you know, managers throughout the system, we can just rotate them from the minor league clubs up to the major league club, and, you know, you don't need a single person. Maybe we can have consistency throughout the system. In theory, that's an okay idea, but Phil Wrigley didn't understand people very well, and what he didn't understand is that a couple of things. One, the natural competitiveness of each of those coaches meant that they wanted to outdo the other guy, so they were never going to give the full support to the man in charge at that moment. And then the other thing is they didn't institute the same procedures throughout the organization. So it's not like every manager was telling players to do things the same way. It was the exact opposite. So you'd have somebody running the team for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks, telling you to hit this way, you know, using this kind of strategy. And then he'd be gone, and another guy would be there, and he would tell players to do the exact opposite. So it was a disaster from the very beginning. It left the Cubs open to ridicule, as it should have. And, you know, it also gave, you know, some guys that a lot of people have never heard of, like Vetti Himsel, you know, he's got his line in the Baseball Register now as being a manager one year. It just really didn't work out, though. That was in 61 and 62.
Yeah, you have this feeling like, you know, a lot of these moves were just out of desperation. try something
else.
Maybe it'll work.
He was trying to do things, but he was just, you know, he was like one step removed from trying to do the things, the regular things they should have done. So he was always trying to do these things that were in some ways innovative, in other ways outlandish. But, you know, baseball is a very conservative business anyway, and he'd try to do these things, and people would just turn around and scratch their heads. I mean, at one point he employed a whammy man, which was a guy who would, you know, sit behind the dugout and put a whammy on the other team. Why did he do this? Well, he'd seen a professional wrestling match, and the whammy man had been used by one of the other wrestlers to put a whammy on the opposing wrestler. Wrigley didn't understand that this was an act. So he actually hires the guy for something like $15,000 to stay with the team all year and put whammies and hexes on the opposition. Only with the Cubs.
One of the more celebrated collapses occurred in 1969, and most of that has been rehashed enough. But one of the things that I didn't realize in reading your book was that there were some incidents that really took some of the luster off of people like Ron Santo and Leo DeRocher during that year, particularly
toward the
end of the season.
Right. The Santo incident you're probably referring to is the one game where that the Cubs lost in excruciating fashion. I believe it was to the Mets, and their center fielder at the time was a young kid, and he loses a fly ball that ends up costing the game, kind of loses it in the haze at Shea Stadium. And after the contest, then I think he comes up and he strikes out, you know, at the wrong time. And after the game, Santo, you know, exploded on him publicly, and guys wrote about it. And very shortly thereafter, that center fielder was sent to the minor leagues, you know, never to return. But a lot of people kind of thought that Santo overstepped his bounds and, you know, blamed someone who didn't deserve all the blame. Then there was, you know, Leo DeRocher, who had received all this credit for turning the team around. And then at one point he decides he'd just gotten married, and he called in sick, but then was spotted at the boys' camp that his wife's son was attending. And it also happened to be Leo DeRocher's birthday. So he jumped the team in the middle of the season and then lied about it to attend a boys' camp. You know, once again, you know, if Lou Piniella was to do that today, you know, he'd be fired before his foot hit the ground, you know, after he first found out about it. But, you know, Leo DeRocher was so powerful within the organization, he had everybody intimidated that, you know, Leo was allowed to stay. Now, the Cubs players said that never really bothered them, that DeRocher's absence really didn't bother them. But I have to think that it caused them to, you know, look at him with a little bit of a jaundiced eye after that. Is this guy really behind us? Is he really committed? And, you know, if he's asking a player to go out on the field and play hurt, you know, yet he doesn't even show up because he just decides to take a couple of days off because it's his birthday, you know, what does that do for team, you know, team morale?
Just a few minutes left. We're talking with Glenn Stoughton about his book on the history of the Cubs. One thing I want to ask you before we let you go, you pointed out how, and it was mentioned earlier in the show, how the Cubs often weren't the best team in baseball, and it took like something like 84, the ground ball through Durham's legs that threw things off, the Bartman play and the Alex Gonzalez error in 2003 to rattle the team and throw things off. Can you make the argument, at least this year, that this may very well be the best team out there?
Well, I really like what's happened with the Cubs this year, and this is what I've liked about it particularly, is that there's not one guy who's having this spectacular season. You go up and down that lineup, a lot of guys are doing pretty good. Nobody's doing overwhelmingly good. You know, not many guys are doing terrible. Everybody's doing pretty good. Same thing kind of with the pitching staff. There seems to be a lot of flexibility and a lot of depth. They haven't been knocked off stride. You know, Soriano misses all that time. Cubs just keep soldiering on. Carlos Zambrano, you know, tweaks his shoulder. Looks like he might be out for a while. Cubs just keep right on going along. So that's, I think, really encouraging, because I think a lot of the teams that you look at in the past, you can take the 69 team as an example, you know, a lot of talent on that team, but not a whole lot of depth. That's a team that wore down over the course of a season. You know, DeRocher rode all those guys hard. Randy Huntley, the catcher, caught almost every day. You know, right now the Cubs seem resilient. They seem made for the long haul. They don't seem like they're getting, you know, flustered. And I think that's really encouraging. I think some of that comes from Pinella. I give him some credit for that because, you know, even though Lou wears everything on his sleeves, he's been through this before. You know, he knows what pennant races are like. And I just like the makeup of this team. You know, it's not like they're not too dependent on offense. They've got pitching. You know, Kerry Wood, I think, has come through in the bullpen much better than a lot of people thought he would. They're just a solid ball club all the way around. And that's the rarity, is that it's an all the way around solid ball club.
I hate to sort of conclude on a downer note, but I have to get your observation about a subject that we've talked about a little bit so far in the hour, and that is the whole steroid question.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a game that's so sensitive to its statistics. What do you think that baseball should do about the steroid era?
What I would like to see baseball do, and I actually wrote a column about this, I'd like to see a plaque in the Hall of Fame with an asterisk on it that would have a starting point of about, 1988 and an end point of about 2007, and just say that, you know, all records during this time period are subject to question due to the widespread use of performance-enhancing drugs throughout the game of baseball. And leave it right there. Put it right in the Hall of Fame. You know, you're not going to be able to change the records. You're not going to be able to peel them back. But put that statement right in the Hall of Fame that just recognizes the fact that, you know, that basically for nearly a 20-year period, we don't know who used and who didn't. We don't know who won pennants or World Series legitimately and who didn't. And quite frankly, just you don't need to have many people in the game cheating, and I think that's what it was. You don't need to have many people in the game cheating. That calls everything into question, everybody's record. You know, if you've got a pitcher cheating, that affects every batter he faced. You know, if you've got a batter cheating, that affects every pitcher he faces. That affects every game. You know, personally, myself, you know, I have found it over the last couple of years a little more difficult to be enthusiastic about the game. And I think that's really sad. Now, some younger people don't even think twice. You know, everybody's different. Personally, you know, it does bother me. And I, you know, look at things that took place in the past. I'm actually a little embarrassed about some of the things I wrote in previous books because now I know different. Now we know that performance-enhancing drugs are in the game and that they affected everything. And, you know, I had to write about them a little bit in the Cubs book, and if I do another one about another team, I suspect I'll have to write about them even more, and I think that's really unfortunate.
Real quick, where's your fan allegiance lie?
My fan allegiance lies, well, I grew up a Pittsburgh Pirates fan.
Okay.
Just outside Columbus, Ohio. So, you know, historically my allegiance has been there, but I have to tell you that over the course of doing this book, my brother at the time was doing some genealogical work on our family, and he discovered that I'm like a distant relative of a former Cub pitcher by the name of Clyde Schoun. So as I write in the introduction to the book, I kind of claim my Cub birthright because Clyde Schoun is the only major league player I'm related to. So I think that counts for something.
We've talked with this afternoon with Glenn Stout, the author of The Cubs, The Complete Story of Chicago Cubs Baseball. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. Mr. Stout, thanks so much. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you.
I enjoyed it as well.